This is Cut to It with Steve Smith Sr., a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio. I'm Steve Smith Sr.
And I'm Gerard Littlejohn.
And this is Cut to It.
Cut to it. Cut to it. Let's get down to it. Cut to it.
We ask the questions you always want to know, but no one ever asks.
Let's cut to it.
I should know it's on. You ain't heard about it, then we're about to let you know. I should know it's on. It's on.
This is part two of our podcast with Jeff Gordon. You heard part one. You heard Jeff talk about being a DJ.
How about breakdancing?
He's from Vallejo, California.
And he's a Smurf.
DJ Smurf. And he started driving a car when he was like 4 years old. That's crazy.
When you're driving a car at 4 years old, do you get diaper breaks?
My mind is blown. I have no idea.
Because you know he tinkling on himself at 4 years old.
You're driving, but I got to have potty breaks.
Yeah. So, hey, well, part two is pretty awesome. You love to hear Jeff Gordon go in depth about his career, 81 pole positions, and just what he's learned about himself as he's gotten older.
Yep. Let's cut to it. Jeff Gordon, part two.
How long of your career did you observe this was maybe a sport that wasn't for everyone?
Yeah. Well, the second year I was in quarter midgets, there was a black family that raced. Mm-hmm. But they were one of the few. I mean, they were one of the very few. And so you knew that it was rare. Right. It was really primarily there was a few female drivers out there, and there are a few, you know, black families that were out there. But it was very rare. And that was in California. So it was probably happened more in California than it happened in other areas. But, you know, I didn't think anything of it at the time.
Because you were always used to being around so many different cultures.
Yeah. And so I was. And then I looked at it as more females start trying. And I had, there was a girl that I raced, a girl named Kara Hendrick, very talented race car driver from Southern California. Unfortunately, she was killed in a race car. Mm. But I thought she was going to be the next Janet Guthrie, you know, or a real major female to go a long way. And it was such a huge loss because it wasn't just what her career was going to do, but how she was going to influence others. But I looked even at the female pool of drivers, and I said, the only way that we're going to find the best to excel at the top level is we got to have more of them competing just like I did and others did before me. Start at a young age. You know, you've got to get the experience. You've got to have the talent. And you know, the only way you can do that is to have a large pool of it. So we got to have more people engaged in the sport. Of all different types of ethnicities and genders, and that's the only way we're really going to have somebody get to the top level and actually be able to, you know, excel at it. And, you know, I mean, I certainly hope that we can find better paths, as you mentioned, to do that at a young age. Because right now, yeah, it's usually not happening. If it does happen, it happens when they're older.
So what was the race culture? You go from California, Indiana, now you're here in Charlotte. What was that race culture from the Midwest, West, to now the South?
Yeah, you know, the South was all about stock cars, right? It was full-fendered stock car racing, and that was new to me. I was an outsider. When I came to North Carolina, people looked at me as an outsider, you know, and
what do you mean an outsider?
Because I'm from California, number one.
Gotcha.
I was racing sprint cars and open wheel dirt cars. Okay. Not anything that most of the guys were racing to excel at NASCAR. You know, you look at, Dale Earnhardt, I think he started racing some kind of stock car on probably dirt tracks when he was 16, 17 years old. You got a later start in racing, and then it was introduced right into stock car, some kind of street stock or some kind of full fendered vehicle, where for me it was very early age open wheel racing and all, you know, just oval stuff. So there's no doubt there was a difference, but you have to understand, I looked at it as, man, you mean to tell me I could race every day of the week in Indiana? You know, I could go to Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, and there was a race happening somewhere. In California, they wouldn't even let me race. And this is the one thing I was – you were talking about racing a car at 5 and 6 years old. I'm going to tell you what, that was nothing compared to driving a full-blown sprint car, 650 horsepower at 13. That one scared
me. Oh, yeah, that's real safe.
Yeah.
That scared the crap out of me. This is when I actually look back on this, especially now as a parent, I'd say to my stepdad, I'm like, you were either crazy or you didn't care whether I died. One of the two. But thank you.
How's it? Look where you are now.
Yeah. Not too shabby.
Yeah. It was nuts, man. Wow. It was nuts. But it worked. Because here I am today, you know, talking about this crazy journey that was created because of those two significant moments, getting introduced to quarter midgets at a young age, getting introduced to that sprint car at 13.
That's crazy.
How'd you deal with not, I mean, even as you talked about coming in from the West Coast, how'd you deal with not being accepted early on as a driver?
I just wanted to prove myself, you know, and I just wanted to fit in, right? I wanted to do everything I could. I probably didn't take advantage of my uniqueness at that time. It was in me, and I had my own path, but I wanted so badly to fit in because I wanted to be there. I wanted to race against them, and I wanted to do more of it, and I wanted to excel at it. And I felt like the only way I could do that is to, you know, say the right things, do the right things, not get in trouble, you know, and go perform on the racetrack. And it wasn't until I got more confidence that, okay, I'm here, I'm established now. Mm. Now I can start to be more me. Mm. And shoot, that probably didn't happen till I retired, to be honest.
I mean,
just because, you know, you're representing sponsors, a fan base, a team of people, and to me, I didn't want to rock the boat. I just wanted to, put my head down, do my job, and represent all those entities the best I could because I wanted to keep doing it, and I was getting paid really well to do it, so I didn't want that to stop.
I mean, you led right into it. NASCAR is heavily dependent on sponsorships, and you know, obviously more than anyone at this table, you know, how much sponsorships, like you said, how much sponsorships play a role in the food on the table, how you travel, just everything is dependent on sponsorships. Why has that always been the case? Like, why is NASCAR always heavily dependent on basically other people investing?
Sponsor-driven.
Sponsor-driven, other people investing in you doing a sport and a skill that you love to do.
Yeah. And it's, if you think, I mean, you could isolate NASCAR or Formula One and kind of have that story because, that's the pinnacle, right? That's where the money is at. Every other form of racing is really hobby racing. Mm. I shouldn't say everyone. I mean, there's guys making a living doing it, but the owners that provide the cars, if they don't have that sponsorship, they're just doing it out of their pocket. And as I mentioned, it's not cheap, you know. And so it doesn't matter what level you're doing it at, you're always and money does buy speed. You know, that's a term that we use. The more money that you can spend on either the best people, the best components in the car, maybe freshest component, if they would allow you to have the freshest engine and the latest, greatest technology, I mean, you're talking about titanium components and, it gets expensive, right? And it makes, so you want more horsepower, you want more speed under the hood, but then you need more downforce, more grip, new tires, the budget can just go through the roof. So you're always dependent on on some kind of income mm-hmm. that goes beyond. If you just took a race car, built a race car, and I'm talking about grassroots racing right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
You built a late model or a sprint car, and you go to the racetrack, and you just went off the winnings. You're not going to make money.
Mm.
You're going to, you know, the winnings, the purse money that you're competing for is not enough.
Wow.
Now, if you get to NASCAR and Formula One, this gets, you know, deep into the business side of things because, you know, you've got a great TV contract for racing, right? It's mm-hmm. not great compared to NFL and yeah. NBA.
But it is for the content.
Yeah.
It's great.
It yeah. is great. And it's you know, has great viewership, mm-hmm. very, you know, a very solid average viewership, very loyal fan base.
Very loyal.
And so then, you know, you take that and what's in the purse through the TV money to do it at the highest level to win, you still don't make money.
Wow.
So you got to have those sponsors and, you know, you hope that you're giving the sponsors enough value of what you're asking for. But, you know, in this day and age with different media outlets, you know, companies are finding ways to spend their money in so many different yeah. areas that just isolating it. Now, live sports are still good, mm-hmm. right? That's mm-hmm. that's still a great way to advertise. So we still have solid sponsors. But, you know, the sports got more expensive and sports marketing and some of the money they're spending on race cars has been kind of going down.
Mm.
That's why you see us have more sponsors. It used to be, you know, STP was Richard Petty, DuPont was
you were Pepsi or Lowe's and Jimmy
yeah,
Johnson.
Yeah, Lowe's and Jimmy Johnson. Those days are you know few and far between now to have one company that can do the full.
So
amount.
Does it take more work to keep multiple sponsors happy?
Oh yeah, yeah. Wow. You gotta do a lot. You know, for them, but that's part of the deal. I mean, ever since I came into racing, my understanding was that it took money to race, and you either had somebody that had the money they wanted to spend, or they had a connection with a company, maybe a B2B type sponsor, or somebody just came in and you know you're meeting people constantly and connecting and
yeah.
and saying, hey, would you like to? I mean, I can remember making phone calls at, you know, 16 years old. Hey, would you like to sponsor my sprint car?
Oh,
you know,
look
my,
at you.
I mean, my parents couldn't afford to do all of it, but they could afford, you know, to introduce me to it.
Mm.
And along the way, you meet people that want to help. They just like racing. Maybe they like you, whatever it is. And they're like, yeah, I would call people. And he's like, yeah, I met you, you know, at this track, and you said you'd be interested in maybe helping us out if we ever. Yeah, what do you need? Well, we're trying to put this program together, and we need a new engine. What's that cost? $30,000. Yeah, man, send me the bill. I'm like,
wow.
He said yes, you know, and you're like, wow, you know, that's
selling
like,
and driving.
Yeah, yeah. So,
well, yeah, I mean, you said it. So, there's such a heavy business aspect of NASCAR. What were the factors, if we so may ask, what led you to move from Ford family to drive for the? For Rick Hendrick and Chevrolet.
Yeah, so when I came into NASCAR, my first opportunity was just random. A guy that I came across at a driving school. It was a NASCAR Buck Baker driving school out in Rockingham, and somehow they knew what my background was, the racing I was doing, because the racing I was doing at that time was these live races on ESPN. So I kind of had built up a name for myself mm-hmm. in that world, but I was really wanting to get into NASCAR and stock cars. And so he gave, you know, he's like, hey man, you know, you want to take a few laps in my car? I'm doing this more just as a hobby for fun. I might do a couple races. He's a business guy.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't a real pure racer. He just liked cars. And so anyway, I got in there and I went really fast. And so he's like, I realized when I saw you making those laps, maybe I shouldn't be in this thing. Maybe you should be in it. And I was like, that sounds like a good idea. And so I drove three races for him that year, a guy named Hugh Connerty. And we sat on the outside front row at Rockingham in my second race. We qualified second.
Hmm.
And all of a sudden, you know, phones started ringing back in Indiana when I got back from that race. And one of them was Ford. And they said, hey, you know, we saw what you did at Rockingham. We'd like to talk to you about an opportunity. And so they really did give me my first real opportunity. Mm-hmm. And it was a great relationship, you know, with Bill Davis, and drove for Ford and Bill Davis for 2 years in the Xfinity, back then Busch Grand National Series. And so all of a sudden things were going really well. Started winning races, started getting a lot of attention. And next thing I know, I'm getting offers from a few different, you know, owners, which I was flattered by, but I wanted to stay loyal to Bill. And we started searching for sponsors, and like, it was, okay, you've got Jack Roush and you got Rick Hendrick and you know, even Cale Yarborough had a team at the time that was talking to me. And I started looking at their organizations, and they're already established. This team was trying to get from Xfinity to Cup. It was a big mountain to climb and a lot of money to do it. And so, you know, it just kind of came to this place where Rick Hendrick made me, you know, like a real offer. I didn't have a contract with Ford past that year, but we were trying to make it work. And I just realized, you know, this is a long road, and this is, man, I get to go right into the best stuff.
Wow.
So, you know, I wish I could say it was a harder decision than it was, because it was a pretty easy one, to be honest.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't hard at all.
It was hard after the decision was made, because I got criticized and judged because everybody looked at me as a Ford guy. You know?
Ford to Chevy is polarizing.
I mean, I was with Ford for a year and a half. You know, my whole career I drove Chevrolet engine cars and non-descriptive cars of a make. But NASCAR is a different deal, man.
That was a polarizing decision.
And you get with that manufacturer, and those fans are locked.
You're supposed
onto
to be brand loyal.
Yeah, brand loyal. And so,
wow.
But so it was the best decision I ever made.
So you were basically disliked because you switched the brand.
Yeah.
And
he's from Cali. Yeah. Annie Young.
And that treats you like a brother.
Well, you know, honestly, you know who it makes me think? It makes me think about Kobe Bryant. Seriously, think about it. Like, he got drafted really early, had success.
Adidas.
First ever guard out of high school. Like, non-traditional background. He came from Italy, spoke Italian. Yeah. Like, think about it. Like, early on success, that ruffles people's feathers. So I definitely get the Kobe Bryant comparison.
It you know, I will say there was a probably a five-year period where just, man, everything I did just turned out good, right? It was just the timing of who I met, the car I got in, the on-track performances.
Just all, like, the success.
Bam, 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 bam. And the next thing I know, I went from, you know, graduating high school to winning a Cup championship like 3-4 years later. Yeah. You know, it was nuts, yeah.
All right, so let's switch gears. We usually call this Let's Talk Ball. But no football,
yeah,
no
same
basketball.
A stick and ball sport. Yeah. So
let's talk gears.
There you go.
So in talking these gears, we're gonna be okay with showing the lack of understanding we have, and for the listeners, it may be dumb questions, but for
there's never a dumb question. I love educating.
You got to school me and Smith.
I love
on NASCAR.
But there are some dumb
sport.
Questions. Yeah, though. Yeah. There really is. Yeah, they're really. I
just
used
imagine.
To think,
imagine NASCAR 101, and you're the professor.
Yes. Okay. Here we go.
I'll try. I'm not a professor, but I told you how bad I was in school.
For us, you are.
Yeah.
I'll pretend.
PhD. Sensei.
Yeah. Did you have a routine while driving? If so, what was that routine?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think a routine is so important.
But we're talking about driving a car, though.
Well, I'm probably talking about routine of prepping to get in the car.
That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, I mean, to me, and you have to understand, and I'm a bit ignorant to you know what your day would have looked like on game day, but on race day, you're with sponsors and fans, and you know, you're interacting with all these different people from the time you get up in the morning on race day. That's just part of it, man. I mean, it's
that part's always
hours,
crazy to me.
Hours.
I would be. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know if it was hours, but you would go to 3 to 4 different hospitalities, suites, or you know, at the race hall, or meeting 5, 10 people that were somehow connected to one of the sponsors on your car.
That's cool.
So you every morning that so at first it was like, man, I can't believe I got to do all this stuff before I go get in the race car. But then it becomes part of your routine. You just got to get into the mental place of, I'm going to talk to these people, but like I'm talking, they're talking through me.
Just nod your head and say yes.
It was hard for it to actually penetrate because I'm thinking, okay,
think about what you got to do.
Wonder what that car is going to feel like for, you know, turn one. Okay, we made these adjustments for practice. So the whole time I'm thinking about that, but I'm interacting and I'm putting on a smile and I'm shaking hands and taking.
That takes skill by itself.
It took a long time to really get comfortable with doing that, and then you go to what they call the driver's meeting, which is basically a bunch of sponsors and dignitaries or whatever that are there. You're really not there learning. It's not like they're saying, hey, here's how you're going to drive the race today. I mean, you already had that all figured out.
I hope so.
If we're trying to figure it out.
It's a day in a race. It's a day in a race. Come on. Hey, you know where the clutch is.
I thought it was a big left turn.
But what really became part of my routine later was from that moment, from the time you finally got away from all of the distractions, was I would go do a warm up, just, you know, and this is more when I got older, my body started failing on me, my back issues and things like that. But just, I'd get on a bike, I'd warm up, do a few stretches, exercises, have somebody, you know, kind of push me a little bit. And then I would go get into my, you know, race uniform. But it was left leg, right leg, left sock, right sock.
Superstitious?
You could look at it that way. I think you could look at it that way. I didn't look at it that way, but I'm gonna tell you what. Right now, if my crew chief walked in, he's like, "Hey, man, what about?" I'd be put my, hang on one second, and go back.
No,
so I did not want to mess up the routine.
Gotcha.
You know, I wasn't about like lucky pennies and anything
like
that.
A baseball player almost.
Yeah. I mean, some
like or eat or like yeah. eat like a. Like eat all your fries, no matter what.
Yeah,
happens.
Like if you were a former pitcher, like Backstage Joe.
Backstage Joe is a former pitcher who they knew he would eat fries and they would do various things with those fries, and he still had to eat them.
He had to eat them all. Because that was his thing.
You know, it didn't have
routine.
The fries had more to do than his actual velocity of arm strength. It was just the fries.
Of course, right? There's no skill involved.
No skill.
And now he has so much, you know, like post-traumatic that it carries over. And like we have to have certain meetings and we have to have certain post-games and
counseling.
All because of Backstage Joe.
So that became a place for me to just kind of get relaxed and ready.
So that routine and that superstition actually was a time for you to kind of reset to go, okay, we're done with the sponsorships. Now we're in race mode.
Yeah.
You still got to go out and do driver introductions.
Yeah, but I'm just saying
absolutely.
After driver introductions, it's on and popping.
The best thing that would happen was, and my wife would even tell you, like when her and my kids were there, because, you know, NASCAR, that's a cool thing about NASCAR is you get to interact with them right until the time you get in the car. It's cool and it's not cool because, you know, you are in this game mode.
Get a little tightly wound.
Yeah, man. I'm wound up whether the day before went good or whatever our situation is. I could not wait to get in that car. I mean, like it could be 100 degrees outside. I'm sweating my butt off, but I'm like, get me in the car because I just want to get in there and get the helmet on, get strapped in, and just truly get into that place. And that was – if I miss anything now that I'm not racing – it's those moments, like you get in there in the anticipation of getting the green flag and going racing and competing against, you know, some of the best out there. That and with a great team and a great car, that was a cool thing to experience.
We have to take a break, and more than anything, we got to pay some bills.
Mm-hmm. Need that check.
I love Cut To It, and I love it even more when you download us and subscribe.
And you can follow us on social media too, Smitty.
Where at?
That's @CutToIt on Instagram.
What about Twitter?
@CutToIt.
Facebook?
CutToIt featuring Steve Smith Sr.
What about online?
And you can follow us at CutToItPodcast.com, where you can buy merch and you can subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts.
I got all my answers. I got all my questions answered.
That's what I'm here for, brother. CutToItPodcast.com.
I've always wanted to ask a guy, especially because I know you've had some rivals. Now, I've watched you drivers sometimes, y'all. Hold me back. Hold me back. Man, I see you guys go after it. But I got to ask you, too, though. Like, have you, like, gotten to that fight mode where I'm a, and then you forget to unbuckle?
Let me unbuckle my seatbelt.
I'm going to whoop his up. Or you still got the harness? Harness!
We get made fun of because we leave our helmets on. Yeah. Right? Like, you get out of the car so fast.
Well, there's been some football players who've been doing that the last couple fights,
like,
too.
Man, if you're going to get in a fight, you got to take your helmet off. It's like, yeah, I probably should have done that.
But, I mean, one time I
flipped over. Car was upside down. And especially in a stock car, when it's upside down, you have an oil tank behind you, and there's hot oil pouring out of that thing, and you're going, I need to get the hell out of here.
Yeah, anyway, I'd say.
And so you're laying upside down. You're like, okay, I know I shouldn't be taking my belts off, but I really want to get out of here. I bet I can get out of here. And you do it. Bad mistake. Worst.
Why?
Because as soon as you unbuckle, you go straight to the roof. Your whole body, you know, weight. And the belts have enough straps and things where usually it's going to catch on something. So now not only are you hanging, but you can't get undone. And it's scary. It's like, God, that wasn't very smart. And so I tipped over. It was a slow roll at Daytona. It wasn't a bad accident, but it did go upside down. But I ended up upside down. And so I undid the belts. I was like, that was stupid. They finally got the car right side up, and I got the belts off of me. But I'd taken my gloves off. And that was the really big mistake, because as I climbed out, I didn't realize the sheet metal had been all torn up, and it just sliced my finger. Ugh. So I get out of the car, and they're like, oh, blood. You know, and immediately they're calling, you know, people over. I'm like, no, it's just my finger, man. I just cut my finger. It was not a great thing. It was embarrassing, but I was like, oh, yeah, leave the gloves on.
So a NASCAR rival mean to Jeff Gordon?
Well, it's funny. It means something different to me now, right? Now that I do TV, I'm like, man, we need rivals.
Oh, yeah, it's
like,
good for business.
Yes. It's like I totally, when I was in it, when I was, you know, like I had a rival with Dale Earnhardt, and he played it up good. I mean, he was a master of that. And me, I was just like, I don't want to have anything to do with that. I just want to go out and do my job. I don't want to get distracted. He's just trying to mess with me and get in my head, get an advantage, or, you know, the media is gonna take something, and then I'm gonna have to answer those questions and deal with it. I don't want to do that. I just want to race. And I wish I'd have played into it a little bit more, because I realize, you know, that the fans, what they love so much is, they, like you mentioned earlier, they love to love somebody, they love to hate somebody, and they love it when there's a rivalry. Mm-hmm. It just builds more interest and gives people way more. The personal aspect of it, the human aspect of it, is sometimes more entertaining than the actual race. And we had a fight this past weekend on Saturday, not in the Sunday race, but the Saturday race. Man, that's all we showed on Sunday was these two guys swinging and going at it.
Did they land anything?
No, they swing and a miss, both of them.
Typical NASCAR fight.
The question is, was it intentionally a miss? You know, I mean, you connect with somebody, you're getting suspended. You probably won't be there the next week. If they see you make contact by throwing a fist, you can wreck a guy like I've done, unfortunately. Yeah. You can do a lot of things, but man, you can't swing and hit a guy.
So what about, would you get suspended for an open palm slap? Since you can't punch.
That's a good
That's a smart way to get around. If you still keep the helmet on, like you can still smack somebody hard enough, and then
there's like competitions, right? Slapping competitions. Yeah. But you can shove. And you can talk smack, but I don't think you could hit him in any
form. Open palm. Open palm is disrespectful.
of course that's you'd say that.
I didn't backhand a few dudes in the locker room.
None. You backhand somebody in the locker room?
It's intentionally disrespectful.
Now hold on. In the locker room, in the locker room, you can do all you want.
So is it fighting in the?
Well, you got to understand the locker room. That's usually just like the locker room to us would be like at the airport getting ready to leave.
Yeah, they don't really have a locker room.
Yeah, it's you know, you have your own individual trailer. But if somebody walked up into your trailer and punched you, or you punched them, that's.
So I want to revisit you backhanding people in your locker. Why would you backhand somebody?
I mean, you get in a little tussle with someone, and not gonna punch because if I'm punching, then it's, you know, we really into it. But open for me, the way I was right, open palm is all disrespectful.
But a backhand that's like some old school. Like so I challenge you to a duel.
So hold on,
no, backhanding is.
So you wanted to show your disrespect, but you don't want to actually get into a real
fight. So let me see. This is where you explain. You're missing. If I backhand you, I'm going to backhand it out of you.
Right.
So what comes next is when I backhand you, you're going to come back, and that's where you're going to catch that two-piece.
This is how you orchestrate NASCAR fights, Joe.
When you backhand somebody one, everybody goes, did he just backhand him? Yes, I did.
Is there like a player supposed to?
And then here's the problem. When he realizes he got backhand, he's going to say, he hit me like a.
Right.
And then he's going to approach.
And then it's on.
Then it goes very quickly. Yeah, I'm back there in a few
people. This is smoke 101.
Yeah. First of all, if I backhand you, I have no respect for you.
Clearly.
No.
I mean, clearly.
No, I mean, zilch.
I don't really think that's a respectable type greeting. If you backhand someone, I would think, he respect the hell out of him.
Yeah. I've
That's a good point. Yeah. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, I never once thought it was like a warm greeting.
Yeah, if I punch somebody, I might just be mad at him. It doesn't mean I disrespect him. But if I backhand you. Yeah.
Anytime you're about to fight somebody and an open palm is done, it's not going to go well. So, all right. So we've digressed, but really want to talk about, which I think is really cool. You've had 81 polls, which is unbelievable. What's the key to getting a poll, and when is the poll captured? Again, I know some of this stuff, but then I'm kind of like, I get the opportunity to talk to a great. And you have done and doing commentary and analyst work, but you also know exactly what these individuals are trying to accomplish.
Yeah, well, first let's establish there's no actual physical poll.
Thank you.
We may even have to start from the beginning. Someone may not even know what it is. Yeah,
so and I think pole position goes back to like horse racing.
Oh, okay.
Where there's like, you know, the pole is the inside.
There's some other jobs that require poles, so I appreciate you clarifying that. You said it like that. Goes back to, I was like, yeah.
Right.
Horse racing. Oh, okay, cool.
Well, I think it may all come full circle in some forms, but you win enough poles.
I see what you did there, Jeff. I see what you did there.
Well, isn't that very thoroughbredish of you?
I see what you did there.
But winning the pole position or being the fastest qualifier, I think obviously, you know, the neat thing about racing is it's a team sport, but it's machine. The machine is the athlete is the way I look at it, right? Like people debate whether race car drivers are athletes, and don't get me wrong, you got to be in very good physical shape. A different type of shape than say like you had to be for football, but you got to be in good shape. But the race car, that's what I want to be the thoroughbred. Mm. I want that race car, you know, to have just a little more downforce, a little less drag, a little more horsepower, just a little more grip than anybody else out there. Now, if all things were equal, which they're not, I'm sorry, it's just not the case. It's just racing 101 the way it's been forever. Somebody's going to engineer something to make one car a little bit better than the next. And NASCAR does an excellent job at trying to create parity and all the different ways that they measure the car and inspect the car. great job. But still, there's always going to be a way to try to get around that. And so, you know, on that day where you go to qualify, it's that machine and it's you, and you're just pushing it to the absolute limit of what that car is capable of doing. And, you know, if you do it right, then you're going to be the fastest one and you're going to win the pole position. And if you mess it up, you're either going to say, okay, I didn't get all of it, or the car wasn't capable of more than I got. And so I would, you know, I like to qualify. I loved being out there on that single lap, just pushing it. And I was always known to be a driver that drove, you know, what we say, deep into the corner. So, you know, there's a lift point at every racetrack. There's not Daytona or Talladega, but on all the other tracks, there's this lift point of where you get in there, you might use brake, not use brake, depending on the track and corner size and everything. And you just want to carry as much speed in there, but you really want to get back to the throttle and carry all the speed through the center and all back onto the next straightaway. So, you know, I love that challenge, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's a purity of being a race car driver.
So why is the pole position so important?
Well, because a couple of things. One is it gives you the starting position to lead the field. You should be able to lead the field. You know, you're side by side, so there's a chance that you might not, but gives you the best opportunity. Plus, it allows you to get a better pit stall. So where your pit crew is going to do their work, if you're the pole position, or if you're number one on the grid, you get to pick where you want to be first.
Ooh.
So it has an advantage throughout the entire race.
And it seems like that's what it's all about, is what tiny advantage can you get every single time?
That's right.
My starting position, where my pit is, the modifications you make on your car. NASCAR is almost like a game of inches.
Well, and you know, we talk about clean air in racing, and what that means is if you're the first car, all the air that's seeing your car, you know, there's nothing disrupting. It's seeing your car first. Okay, so it's attaching itself, giving you the best performance.
Mm.
As soon as you're the next one back, that air is doing all this. It's all just dancing all over the place. Yeah. So it's like getting in a jet wash of an airplane, and you know, they just. It's not going to attach itself to your car. And so you are already at a disadvantage. Mm. Now, if you're 5-10 cars back, like you got nothing. You got no air getting to your car.
Just random now just made me think, do you believe NASCAR will transform, talking about Clean Air Act, talking about climate change, just my thoughts when you said that, do you believe NASCAR will transform itself into electric vehicle racing?
Well, one day they'll have to. I mean, you know, I think NASCAR plans to be around for a long time. A lot of the race teams plan to be around for a long time, and you see where the future is going in automobiles. So it's happening now. You know, is it electric? Is it?
Because it's 30 minutes to charge, though.
But I'm just something that is
even
more,
a supercharge station is 30
I get what
minutes.
You're asking. It's something that's more sustainable, though.
Yeah,
right.
But I wasn't
asking like higher level. I was asking bare bones. Yeah, do you believe electric cars? Because
a lot of what we do is driven by the OEMs, right? Mm-hmm. And so if they're
OEMs, though.
Oh, that was,
I said yeah, but I really I was like I don't really think I know.
Basically,
what that
means. The manufacturer of the vehicle.
Oh, okay, you know? Okay.
So Chevrolet and Ford and Toyota or any other manufacturer that wants to come into NASCAR, if they say, listen. Electric vehicles is our future. That's what we're going to be building. We need to find a path to introduce that to NASCAR.
Wow.
Then it's going to happen. I think there's already discussions about it, but I think that what you're going to see is similar to what we've seen in Formula One. Now, there's an all-electric Formula series out there right now, and what they do is they swap cars. It's crazy. So they start in one car and run that thing till the battery's out. Come in
and get
into another car. And then now I heard that this year they're going to have one car with one battery, but it's all about managing the power throughout the whole race. So like you might say, hey, right now I'm going to use 20% of my battery to pass these two cars ahead of me, but then I'm going to have 20% less later.
Yeah.
And right now I'm just talking about the one car, but yeah, this series, it's called Formula E. When they started, you had two cars because they couldn't run long enough.
I know.
Because it took so much power.
Because of the speed. Yeah. If you have the speed.
Exactly.
I have an electric car, so that's why I was asking.
Yeah. So what? But what's going to happen, I think, and what we've seen in Formula One, where they introduce electric motor just for boost, right? Just for extra power, just to help the car accelerate off the corner. And now you're starting to see Ferraris and other cars that have Porsche, Ferrari, that has this in it that makes the car actually perform better. So you take a gas-powered engine and the electric power. I think that's what you're going to see NASCAR do initially. Whenever that time comes, they'll probably just have some kind of electric motor, and it might be a boost to pass, right? To that you get to use so much of it throughout the race. Like maybe it regenerates
the extra
itself.
Extra you earn it, like in
not fan vote.
or you're like, hey, you got to win two replays overturn to get the third one.
Yeah, I mean, there's some of that. So I think it's going to – now, I will tell you this. If we ever go all electric, the thing I'm going to push the hardest for is that it's got to make some kind of sound, right? Like I don't want to hear the hissing and whistling of the drivetrain or the electric motor winding up. There's technology out there right now for electric vehicles, that make their own – amplified sound. Just make it sound cool, whatever it is. You know, if Chevrolet or Ford or Toyota says, okay, we're going all electric, no problem. But, man, give me some cool sounding thing that when that car goes by, I'm like, I'm not going to say that's a V8. I'm going to say that's a kick-ass sounding car.
Yeah.
Just happens to be electric.
I think it's about that time. Just take a little breather.
Cut to it. Cut to it. Let's get down to it.
Hey, Gerard, where did you get that t-shirt?
You mean this thing?
Oh, yes.
I got it from CutToItPodcast.com, where we have exclusive merchandise. Shout out to our guys at 704 Shop. But yeah, you can go on, buy you a t-shirt, subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts.
In 1999, you founded the Jeff Gordon Children's Foundation. Why was that important for you to do? You already had so many things going on, raising a family, traveling around the world, racing, and to try to establish a foundation. Take us through that. Why was that important for you?
I mean, I think at that time in my life, I always go back, to the beginning and who my parents are, what they taught me, and my parents always loved helping other people. It didn't matter what was going on in our lives. Somebody needed help, boom, they were there to lend a helping hand or do what they could for them. And so I think I kind of go back to that, but I looked at my own career, my success, and I said, there's got to be more than just collecting trophies and winning races, and what can I do to give back? And along the way, one of my crew chiefs, Ray Evernham, his son was diagnosed with leukemia. So I didn't know a lot about pediatric cancer and how it affected children and families until that happened. Mm-hmm. And when it hit close to home then. And I had met a lot of kids through Make-A-Wish. Mm-hmm. And so I think, the combination of meeting kids through Make-A-Wish, what Ray had gone through with his son, I wanted to do something that I thought I could give back. And because I met so many kids that had this, I realized there's a real need out there. Mm. So I wanted to do things for pediatric cancer. So that's where it all started.
Mm. Well, you guys do an amazing job being able to work on Smitty's Foundation. We've definitely have paid attention, and you guys do just an incredible and impactful work. So definitely hats off to you. And we definitely see that from afar, but then just being here within the Charlotte community, greater North Carolina, South Carolina community, you have an incredible impact on a lot of people.
I appreciate it. I'm really proud of what we've done. I thought when I retired, that would be something that I could spend more time with, but also I didn't know what the future would hold for it. Not being in the race car, being able to promote it, wasn't not making the kind of money I was driving, and yet it's just continued to rise and take off. So I've always had great people surrounding me on a race team, and I've got great people on our foundation team, and they've just surpassed anything I could have ever hoped for. Thank you.
Our last segment is called Deep Three, and basically these are three questions that takes us to a deeper level outside of who you are as a race car driver, as an analyst, and all the different hats that you wear. We want to know about you.
So I don't know how I get much deeper. I mean, we opened this thing up with some
past your DJ skills. So, yeah. Smitty, go ahead and ask him the first one.
You've done a ton of interviews, now doing your TV work. What is something you've never been asked in an interview about yourself that, you know, it gets overlooked?
Yeah. I mean, I did a book when I in my final year in retirement, so I feel like I got asked everything. I think most people probably stay away from, you know, my biological father and that side of my life and upbringing, and really don't dive very deep into the Vallejo stuff either, you know, of what that was like. But I don't know, I feel like we kind of touched on some of that. So, God, you know, when you've been doing this as long as I have, I feel like I've been asked everything. I can't think of anything I haven't been asked. I'm not. Yeah, that one might keep me speechless. I'm not sure.
You've mentioned NASCAR has diehard fans. How does your relationship to your fans change from the beginning of your career, now to the end?
Yeah, I think it's gone through a wave of interactions, because I think it started out as, and you brought this up early on when we started this, about I started getting cheers, you know, new guy on the track, and oh, you know, he's doing good. Oh, you know, might have a new guy to cheer for, or maybe they liked the way my car looked, whatever it was. And I was like, ooh, I'm starting to hear some cheers. That's awesome. That feels good. And then I started winning more, and I was racing with Dale Earnhardt Sr., right? Became rivalries, and all of a sudden those cheers quickly turned into boos that were definitely louder than the cheers. And so then I was at this place where I was like, I don't like them. You know, I don't like them for, you know, why do they not, they don't even know me. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, you get experience with it and you go, okay, I realize that has nothing to do with me personally. It's what they're passionate about, and I respect that. And so I think I went through, and also with my own fans, I went through this place of, you know, hey, don't bother me while I'm eating. Don't bother me in the bathroom. Don't, you know, like, give me my personal time. If I'm with my family, you should know. But I'm actually, you know, I think now that I'm removed from it and not in it as entrenched from a race car driver standpoint, now I'm like, man, anybody that followed me, fan of mine, that wants to, you know, get that picture, I'm all for it. And okay, there's still limits, but there's still a few minutes.
One little disclaimer. Yeah.
But I think I have a greater respect and appreciation for their giddiness, their, you know, their excitement, or you know, the you know, take. I don't know if I've ever been that big of a fan of anybody's or any one thing to fully relate. But I do know that some of the times that I've met some cool people, I was like, you know, okay, I might at this moment go, this is my one opportunity. Yeah. I'm going to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
I've done that before. Mm-hmm. And so I get it now, you know, and so I think I've just, the things kind of come full circle from, oh man, I love this, to, oh man, I don't know if I like all this.
Yeah.
And then didn't think I liked the ones that were against me. Now I'm like, man, the more the merrier, make all the noise. Like, I love now seeing fans. We had a kid on TV this past weekend, had a big sign saying, you know, I hope anybody wins but Kyle Busch, you know, and you know, Kyle Busch kind of gets some heat for some of that stuff. Mm. But man, people are listening, people are watching what he's doing. Mm. And I think it's about embracing it. That's the one thing, you know, I was always afraid of, okay, what are people going to think, or how's this going to affect our sponsors or our career? I wish that you could just go out there in NASCAR, no sponsors, number on the car, your team, your race car, and just go race and be you, like completely be you. That would be one entertaining form of racing. But you know, I think we're all sort of held to some sort of standard that we've got to live up to keep us in check, or might get out of control.
So that leads me to the final question. Hearing Jeff Gordon of today, if you go back in time and talk to Jeff Gordon, 21, 22 years old, what would you tell him?
Oh, my gosh. Well, would I be able to tell him how good things are going to go?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that it's crazy. I'm almost 50 now, and I feel like, you know, I'm still learning things about me that it's so cool to be in that place where you're just like, you know what? I've lived a great life, and I'm very comfortable with who I am, and I'm sure that will even get greater as I go along. I wish that even though I had a lot of confidence on the racetrack, off the racetrack, you know, you have those insecurities. You have those those things where you're just not so sure. And I see now, you know, just being able to what I see people relating to the most is people that are just genuinely being them and not holding back. And I always just held back a little bit. Was it because I was from California? Was it because I raced open wheel? Was it, you know, the type of sponsors that I had? I'm not sure, but I always held back. I always held back just a little bit, not necessarily on the track, but off the track. And, you know, I don't have many regrets, but you know, I would probably just would have wanted people to see a little more of me along the way. Media, friends, fans, because, you know, at home, I mean, they get to see that, but, you know, just wasn't always there when I was racing or at the track. That when I came to NASCAR, a lot, and again, this is just people not really even knowing me, just assumed that I got handed everything on a silver platter and that I had the easy street. And don't get me wrong, I mean, it went well, but I had to work my ass off.
Yeah,
you know, and a lot of things, you know, lined up, but I felt like I had to earn it. Maybe I didn't have to earn it like Earnhardt had to earn it, but I had to do it in my own way.
But
in
your own way is key.
But it lined up based off the fruits of your labor. Like, it lined up because you raced and met someone. They gave you their number. Then after your race or a couple of days or weeks later, you had to keep that piece of paper. Then you had to call them. They had to pick it up. And then you had to speak. They had to accept it. Like, it's not you were given everything. You had to do it. You had some sweat equity into it.
And the thing I can relate, you know, with you about is that there were certain people out there that it didn't matter what I said, what I did. I could sit there and have an hour-long conversation with them, and they were going to walk away with that going, yeah, Jeff Gordon, he had it easy. Or you know, man, he got so lucky.
They were going to judge.
Yeah,
they were going to judge.
And so, you know, I learned along the way. Okay, I got to stop trying to convince everybody of how I got here, why, and just go do my thing. And you know, luckily that thing worked out pretty good.
The mistake I made was I knew the reporters and what they wanted. I knew some reporters had a preconceived notion of me.
Yeah.
So I gave them the lazy, cursing Smitty.
You gave them exactly what they were.
I gave them exactly what they wanted, because if I spent an hour with them and then after that hour, a couple of days later, the article was written, I was the son of a... Like, I gave them so much of who I am, and they took that and just wrote this.
Yeah.
And I kind of was like, it doesn't matter what I say. Like, everybody always says that, like, Steve had a chip on his shoulder. If I break down, when I was in college, coming out of college, I broke my C4 vertebrae. I went to the University of Utah. It was not considered a good school. I was 5'9". A guy drafted by the New York Jets from the University of Miami, named Santana Moss, was drafted in the first round, had the same height as me, but he wasn't too small. Huh. And the reason I'm saying that is, obviously I'm not jealous of Santana Moss, but when you compare, it's like, well, he's an apple, I'm an apple.
Right.
Right? Now, yeah, he may be, he's from Florida, so his apple maybe tasted sweeter, but he's still an apple, right? He had a better product. He was a, you know, Honeycrisp. I was a granny apple. Right? I can still be used.
I'm impressed with your knowledge of apples.
Yeah. Right. Right? And so I always felt it was like I didn't have a chip. It was I never got the benefit of the doubt. Like, I broke my neck in college. You know why they didn't fuse my neck? Because I was told if you got your neck fused, you automatically were not a draft eligible. Fourth round draft pick, Chris Winkie. He broke his neck at Florida State, won Heisman. You know what they did? They fused his neck. He actually signed 2 days before. Listen to this. He signed 2 days before training camp as a fourth round draft pick and got more signing bonus money than me.
Wow.
Well, all I can tell—I don't know a lot about Santana Moss. I know the name, but I've watched a lot more, Panther games than I watched whatever team he played for. And what I saw on the field was a guy that was just a fighter, man. Just digging, just getting after every single play. And maybe it was exactly that. What I like about my side of viewing you. Right, is that now as I've gotten to know you better, especially sitting down here, is all those things that happened in your life, like that was in you on that field, right? Yeah. That was making you do things that were pretty extraordinary, and it might have been something you're battling with, emotionally and internally,
yeah.
But I think there were a lot of positives that came out
absolutely
on how you played the game.
Yeah. I'll be honest, just after talking to you, I'm like, we've been here 20 years. We've met each other here and there, but, man, never really. I've met one or two other drivers, and I'll be honest, I just don't see and identify and kind of see the relationship just because there's just two different sports. You also, I felt like at times I'm getting that best version of them. And when I get the best version, I'm like, man, I'm still figuring out my version of me. So, man, after hearing you talk and just, man, it's like, man, I'd love to, grab a bite to him and just grab a bite with you and just kind of chomp it up and talk and hear the more parts of Jeff Gordon that makes you you.
Well, so, I appreciate it. Listen, I love opportunities like this that you've given me to kind of pull back the layers and open up a little bit more and hit me with some different things that, I don't normally get hit up with, so that's cool. And and just mad respect, too.
Yeah,
I love being able to sit down and hear other people's journey. So we got to get that bite. If I'm coming, it's probably going to be mixed with some kind of a beverage.
Okay.
I feel you, Jeff.
But
I'm not judging.
I'd love to to hear more about your journey.
We're going to do something different. I'm Steve Smith Sr.
I'm Gerard Littlejohn.
And I'm Jeff Gordon.
And this is Cut to It. You are a unique person. You are well worth it. You are competent. And most of all, you're lovable. Cut to It with Steve Smith Sr. That is me. Is a production of Cut to It LLC, Balto Creative Media, The Black Effect, and iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
From Cut to It, executive producer Steve Smith Sr., co-host Gerard Littlejohn, talent and booking manager Joe Fushi, social media team Wesley Robinson and John Cho. From Balto Creative Media, Cut to It is produced by Brian Baltashevich and Meredith Carter, with production assistance by Alex Lebrecht, production coordinator Taylor Robinson. Theme music by Alex Johnson, lyrics and vocals by Anthony Hamilton.
If you ain't heard about it, then we're about to let you know.
You know it's on.
It's on.